Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Center for New Work, Education, and Design here at Two River Theater, the Hackensack Meridian Health Riverview Medical Center, Studio B. That's all we have time for tonight. Sorry. So glad you could join us here at Two River Theater for Radio Golf. I'm Doug Doyle, the news director for WBGO, and seated right next to me is someone who really doesn't need introduction, but we're going to give him his due anyway. He has directed two shows by August Wilson already for this theater. You undoubtedly have heard of the Obie Award winner, Brandon J. Durden. Now, you might not know that Radio Golf is actually the last of the cycle's 10th and final play. It was set in 1997. Someone who is crucial to this show, and I want you to put yourself in his shoes. Elder Joseph Barlow is the character, and his home sits right in the middle of what would be an amazing development in Pittsburgh in the Hill District. Wayne DeHart, the amazing actor, plays Elder Joseph Barlow, and as we go through this discussion tonight, I want you to feel what this character is facing. He is facing gentrification. He is facing blight in the neighborhood, and you can see if you side with him. We want to welcome Wayne DeHart. August Wilson died in October of 2005. The first performance of Radio Golf was April 22nd, 2005. August never saw this play come to Broadway. Radio Golf, being directed by Brandon J. Durden, no stranger to the work. How many of you saw Brandon on Broadway in Jitney in 2017? A lot. He was absolutely amazing as Booster. August Wilson's in your blood, right? He has become such an inspiration to you. You've told me in past interviews, he's earned the level of excitement because we've seen him on movies with fences. We've seen Jitney on Broadway recently, now here at Two River Theater, Radio Golf. And you've told me eventually all of his shows will be revived. Tell us about the excitement that he has earned.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, welcome everybody. It's so good to be among family and to see you all here. And even though we aren't presenting the play tonight, it's so wonderful that your interest has already peaked enough to even spend some time beforehand. And I think that points to the excitement that August generates. I mean, here we have, a wonderful evening where you could have been doing many things. But at the top of your list was to be here and hear us talk about the man, not even see his work, but talk about the play and talk about his work and just to share our space and really revel and celebrate what August means to all of us and what he's bringing, what he's still bringing forth into the world. So I think that absolutely points up to the level of earned excitement, as I guess I once put it. But I think that is absolutely true. What August was able to do in his all-too-short lifetime with his 10-play cycle, the American Century Cycle, as it's been named, was to chronicle the life experience of a particular group of people. And that particular group is our African-American people in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, with the exception of one play, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is set in Chicago. But through this particular, we see the universal. And that's the genius of August Wilson. And many would point to, in the same breath, that's the genius of William Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams or Eugene O'Neill, is that through the specificity, we are able to see our universality, but also to really celebrate, to see what is of value in the specifics of the way that these people that populated August Wilson's environment, to see the value, the inherent value and the inherent humanity in this particular group of people, which I think is all too often overlooked by a myriad of circumstances in this country. But we celebrate August's genius for elevating this often overlooked way of life. He elevates it properly to where it belongs, which is at the great center of humanity, which is where we all are. And I think that's the gift that he's given us, is the ability to see in ourselves and others and to celebrate that.
Brandon J. Dern brings immediate respect when you know he's directing, because you saw him in his directorial debut right here at Two River Theater for Seven Guitars, and then he directed King Hedley. So he's been in August Wilson plays, and now he's directed. But there's somebody who actually has been involved in more of the August Wilson plays. In fact, eight of them. It would have been nine had he not had a film that he had to make, and that's Wayne DeHart. Wayne, you know August Wilson better than anyone as far as you've been in eight of these shows. What makes Radio Golf, in your mind, before we get into the specifics, different for you? And you've said you were thrilled when Brandon gave you a call and said, I want you to play Elder Joseph Barlow.
Well, Elder Barlow is the little man. There's several lines that I have in the show that says how, talking about Harmon's father, how he treated people. He drew a line. He put the little man on one side, the big man on the other. My character is the little man. And I was telling somebody today, it's a chance for him to express, to open his mouth and to say, so he feels he's being wrong. And he feels he's fighting an army, which is the government and the city and all that. But this is one voice. And he persists in shouting it down the walls until he can bring the walls down. And he finds that he gets some help along the way to help him in his voice. But the thing that I do like about him, that he is the small voice in the far forest that you never hear. But he goes about his job of getting his situation rectified and stuff in his own way. And August, the thing, his characters, like August, there'll be the African diaspora that we brought over here is always somewhere in August's plays, where he talks about the spirituality of what these people brought over with them to America and how it's ingrained in the cultures over the 10 plays. There'll be some characters sometimes that'll be in his 1920 play, and you'll hear them talk about them in his 1960 play also. So these people lasted throughout the neighborhood. He established them that they are in the neighborhood, and they transcended the years and stuff. So just his writing is just so poetic that, I just say the people, there are people who spend their lives studying Shakespeare, and I would like to be an actor who spends my life studying August Wilson.
How does the relationship between you two develop, where you said, I want Wayne to play Elder Barlow? Well,
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, for those who don't know, Wayne DeHart, he resides in Houston, Texas, my hometown. And, growing up, he's one of the statesmen of Houston, Texas. He's a staple there. He is one of the most revered actors in Houston. And through my travels around the country as an actor and director, one thing that I've come to learn is that, greatness knows no boundaries. It has no zip code. And so me being here at part of the Two River family and wanting to honor you all who honor us with your presence and your time and your commitment and your participation in this journey as we celebrate the canon of August together, I want to bring you the best. And immediately, the first call that I made when John asked me to direct this play, I said, well, I can do this, but I have to have Wayne DeHart. I mean, we have all this talent in New York. We have it all in New Jersey. But if I'm going to bring you the best, if I'm going to honor the audience that continually shows up and shows out, if this man says yes, I'm more than halfway there. And as you'll see, what Wayne brings is unparalleled. He's such a champion, as you hear him talk about August, so passionately. He's such a champion for this work, and he's so naughty as an actor. He really is. It's just a joy. I grew up, I watched him on stage several times. This is my first time actually being able to work with Wayne. And it's everything that I hoped it would be. So I'm so grateful that he answered the call. And, you know, in Houston, we don't really get below 50 degrees too often. And so I thought maybe there was some reservation when he knew the time period that I was going to ask him to be spending some time out here in New Jersey. But he didn't let the cold scare him. And he hopped on the first thing smoking. And I think we're all better for it. And I can't wait for you to see the genius of this man, Wayne DeHart. It's just, you can't teach it. You know, it's ingrained. And he's such a wonderful anchor. He calls himself the little man in the play. But Wayne's presence in the rehearsal hall is giant. And it's a gentle giant, you know. And it's for the rest of the younger cast members who are well on their way to getting the experience that Wayne already brings so effortlessly. It's like watching a master class every time. And so when I'm giving notes at the end of a run or in rehearsal and I'm offerings, what I call notes, they're offerings. I tell all the actors, say, look, direct, it's just advice. You can take it or you can leave it. But I happen to think it's pretty good advice, so I encourage you to at least try it. Right. And so when we're in note sessions often, I'm having to think, I hope Wayne doesn't feel like I'm not noticing him because I'm not saying anything to him or giving him notes. But, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But there's such a generosity of spirit that Wayne brings, to the work, not only as the character Elder Joseph Barlow, but also as an ensemble member. And that's the one thing that is so important about putting together an August Wilson play, is that you have to be particular about who you invite in the room. There is no protagonist or singular protagonist or antagonist in many of his plays. The protagonist, and I often say this, is the community. And so I'm building a community when I invite a group of artists into the room. And when we invite you into the audience, you're part of the community. So I have to be very, very, very protective of how we build this community. And so when I have the ability to have a statesman, to have a master artist like Wayne DeHart, and he accepts so graciously to be a part of this community, I'm really over the moon by it, and I can't wait for you to see why.
And now you know, Wayne.
I've been through a couple of things in my life that have given me challenges where, you know, I probably should have, could have gone off to L.A. or New York, but I always had this theory that I was a rose in a cactus garden, and that you can't miss me if you, but I've lost my eye to glaucoma. I lost my left leg because of circulation things. And each time I laid there on the bed, I said, my career is over. I said, shit, I'm a better actor than that. I don't need but one eye. Hell, I don't need but one leg. So I said, just get up and go do it. That's what I do. So they,
That's wonderful. Wayne, since you have been in so many of August Wilson's plays, how have you changed? How has the work that you've done changed you through all these years? What kind of changes have you made in your own life as a result of being a part of the legacy of August Wilson?
I'd say, you know, personally, first of all, I wouldn't want to change me for no reason at all. I love me just the way I am. But if anything, it shows how his characters listen to each other. And so it makes me listen to people more. If I see somebody that looks a certain way, I say, there's a story behind that. I can't just take for judge for what I see. So it makes me go think about things and stories. And so many of his shows have these life lessons that you learn that they teach you how to lean toward that decision making. So it's probably, you know, helped me a little bit better than that. And so I tend to listen to people more. I tend to, you know, find out what their story is before I judge them or anything like that. Maybe that.
For those of you that are just joining us, we're talking about August Wilson's Radio Golf that will be running at the Joan and Robert Rackmix Theater here at Two River Theater from February 29th to March 22nd. And we are joined by the director, Brandon J. Durden, and one of the fine actors who's playing the role of Elder Joseph Barlow, Wayne DeHart. Brandon, now that the fact is that the cast has come together, I saw you before, you were working them with the intensity that I always see from you. What do you want to tell us about the cast?
I'd like to say that most of this cast, with the exception of Amber Mann, who was in a play here last season. This is their first experience with Two River Theater, and I'm so excited about that because part of being an artistic community is finding new voices and welcoming new people into the fold to help the continuum of the storytelling. This is a very noble profession, what we do. And I try to remind the cast of that responsibility. And what I want you to know about these five individuals, four of whom you may not have seen before, is that we have assembled a cast that respects and honors that duty to you. They take it very seriously, their responsibility as storytellers. I mean, what's older? I mean, what in the history of the world is older than people sitting in a room together telling stories about how to be better at coexisting? And so it's a real privilege to be an artist, to be a director, to be an actor, and we don't take that lightly. We really respect that, and we really honor your time. We honor your commitment to us, and not only that, but they are some of the finest actors you're going to see. It's a special, special, special group, and I'll go into any war with these individuals.
From the title, you might think that this is about a golf tournament or something. Now, there is a radio show about golf in this play, but it goes way beyond that, and why the person who has the show will let that go until you see the actual play. What do you want to tell us about 1997 Hill District, Brandon, and how this is all set up with the real estate developer, Harmon Wilkes, determined to be the first black mayor in Pittsburgh? By the way, there still hasn't been a black mayor of Pittsburgh, in all these years. Tell us the plot as much as you want to tell us.
Sure. You know, it's so funny because when you talk about an August Wilson plot, it's usually easy to distill it down to two or three sentences. Not a whole lot happens plot-wise in August Wilson plays. That's not the beauty of the play. The beauty is the relationships and the journeys and the yarn spinning and seeing how people interact with each other. So basically, in a nutshell, we are 1997. The Hill District is in Pittsburgh, basically a barren wasteland. It's a food desert. There are no grocery stores. And we're waiting on these two developers, Harmon Wilkes, who has history in the neighborhood but no longer lives there. His father was a very successful realtor in the neighborhood. And his partner, Roosevelt Hicks, and they went to school together at Cornell, and now they are big developers. And they have an aim to bring in a huge new development with 180 apartment unit buildings, complete with a Whole Foods and a Starbucks and a Barnes & Noble's bookstore to revitalize this community. And it's just the beginning. They have big plans. And one of the other aspects they're going to do is they're going to put up where the football field used to be. They're going to put up a golf driving range for the community. And so we follow their efforts to gentrify this forgotten Hill District. We're waiting for the city council to declare it blighted so that they can begin demolition and construction on this new project. But there's some hiccups. Then we have drama. Now we have a play. At the heart of this play is 1839 Wiley, which is the home of Aunt Esther. Aunt Esther being a character that August Wilson first introduced in Two Trains Running, when characters go and visit the mystical, mythical Aunt Esther to get their soul cleansed or the soul washed. Aunt Esther is later explored in King Henry II, where we find out her death in 1985, and within the context of August's 10-play cycle. And then Aunt Esther actually gets a whole play in Gem of the Ocean, which is set in, I believe it's 1904. And that's chronologically, that's the first play of the cycle, but the second to last play that he actually wrote. Gem of the Ocean was the play that he wrote directly before finishing Radio Golf. So this is one of the bookends of the Aunt Esther story. So now we're dealing with 1839 Wally that sits right smack dab in the middle of this development that Harmon and Roosevelt want to proceed with. And we find out that there's a hitch in ownership. Who really owns this house? And metaphorically, I mean, I think it extends to not just physical ownership, but culturally. Who has the ownership of everything that Onesta represented?
That's my house. I got my record on, deed on record on Dakota. My mother put it down there in 1925.
Wayne DeHart, you play Elder Joseph Barlow, and in character there. As I mentioned when we started this, we can relate. Put yourself in his shoes, his own legacy, his family, his love of where he's at. His whole life is in that home, and somebody wants to take it away and bulldoze everything over. We've seen this in different places. Maybe you said to yourself at times, who would be the one that would stand in the way of progress? Just get out of the way, old man. You don't do that, do you?
And basically, it's not for himself. It's for his daughter. He want everybody. Brandon has drilled in us that everybody in this play wants to be a better person, wants a better life. He wants, he knows he's about to die, maybe for 20 years, but he wants his house for his daughter. And he wants that legacy to keep on.
We like to do things that we can pass along to our loved ones and say, look what we've done. And Brandon J. Durden has said for his young son, Chase, I want you to say, Daddy, you're making art you can be proud of. He's getting to that age almost where he's going to start understanding your work.
Oh, he's well past that age. You know, Chase, he'll be 6 next month. And he visited last weekend, and he sat in rehearsals, and he watched a bit. And I asked Chase, I said, so how's it going? And he says, well, he says, Daddy, I think the actors really need to feel what the characters feel. They need, he says, if they feel what the characters feel and they care about what the characters care about, when the audience comes to see that show, they'll say, wow, that director is superb.
He knows Dad, doesn't he? Wow, that's a great relationship. I love it. And of course, you know, with Mom being an actress too, we understand why Chase has it in his blood. Something that's in the blood of Wayne DeHart, you might notice his outfit tonight. His hat, Buffalo Soldiers, and the Buffalo Sabres hockey shirt is not because he's a hockey fan, but the emblem is very close to something very near and dear to his heart. For many, many years, Wayne has been a part of the Buffalo Soldier National Museum performances, reenactments, and has performed the life of a Buffalo Soldier since 2001. Tell us why that's so important to you. And tell us, Buffalo Soldiers, for those of you that aren't aware, the regiments in the U.S. Army back in 1866 was 6 all-black cavalry and infantry regiments. It was segregated. Why is this so important to you, Wayne?
Because of the sacrifices these men made. They weren't even looked upon as real men. But the Union Army was actually losing the Civil War, and they needed more soldiers. The only place they could get them were from the newly freed slaves and freedmen of that time. And they sent them out. Well, actually, they had sent some white soldiers out west because the United States was moving out toward the west, and they couldn't deal with the heat. So they sent the black soldiers out there to become pretty much the police force of the west. And they performed their duties. I mean, they were given less pay than everybody else. All of their equipment was less than anybody else and things. They were just put in some very strenuous situations, but they persevered, and they you know, became what, you know, we honor now today, the Buffalo Soldiers. But they didn't get that kind of recognition even then. I mean, even the term cowboy, they were called cowboys. Cowboy was originally a derogatory term meant to describe the black men who took care of the horses for the cows. They called them cow. They would not call them cowmen, so they called them cowboys. And eventually they did their job so well that they this name took on a whole nother meaning. So they wore it, they took the label, they wore it, and they performed their jobs and stuff in the places. We went to somewhere in Iowa where we walked into town and they said, the Buffalo Soldiers haven't been here in 100 years. Oh, my God, I was just so glad to see you. I was like, whoa, gee, how many black people y'all got living around here? And they said, there's two over in the next town. I said, you probably know their Social Security numbers and everything. But these men, and I didn't serve in the service, so when I'm around all the gentlemen, the troopers from the Buffalo Soldiers, I feel like, you know, when they see me perform, I don't want them to see an actor doing a monologue. I want them to think that someone, one of their brethren, stepped out of the past and said, I'm here for a few minutes to display some information. And I just feel I have a responsibility to them to do the best thing that I can do with this thing when I do perform.
Yeah, and hopefully, Doug, pretty soon the Red Bank audience will get a chance to see Wayne's Buffalo Soldier reenactment. I'm going to put it on the spot, but we're already in conversation with Gilda Rogers, the magnanimous Gilda Rogers, who is with the T. Thomas Fortune Foundation. And so we're working out schedules now and so we can get a performance, so we can offer that to our audience as well. So stay tuned for that.
You know, one of the reasons that I bring that up is you can hear the passion when Wayne talks about it. You get a real sense of what makes this guy tick and why Brandon would reach out to Houston, Texas, to bring Wayne here for you. I want you also to think about Two River Theater. This is the sixth of the 10 plays. I think that deserves a round of applause in itself. You come to Two River, they come to you. How does that work now? Can you have a relationship and say, I want to do radio golf, or do they say, we want to do radio golf, Brandon?
Oh, that's a question above my pay grade. That's you know, John Diaz, the current artistic director, is such a wonderful leader that I think, you know, what he does is he fosters a place to become family. And I think that any audience member who spends 20 seasons with us can attest to that. And one thing that we do as family is we, you know, we make space to have family members excel and to grow in that thing that we're good at, you know? And so I think John, when I first came as an actor in 2012 with August Wilson's Jitney, directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson, we just an off-the-cuff conversation one night over at Danny's, and I said, you know, one day I'd like to direct a production of Fences with Ruben Santiago Hudson as Troy and this other actress who's been here, Brenda Presley, as Rose. And John, and I hadn't had any notion of being a director at this point. I hadn't directed anything. And John, he remembered that. And years later, he says, I remember you said that you one day wanted to direct Ruben Santiago Hudson in a production of Fences. We're not doing that. I don't think you're ready to handle Ruben Santiago Hudson as an actor. Says, but we are committed to doing all 10 of August's plays. And we have 7 guitars coming up. And this is, he says, and I see the way you work, and I see the passion, and I see your understanding. Let's give it a shot. And so that was a start of my relationship with Two River as a director, after having acted in, I think, 4 previous shows here. And, you know, nobody died. I thought, you know, it turned out pretty well. And he says, well, let's keep it going. Let's keep this ball rolling. And so I'm finding my voice as a director through this work at this very safe place. I mean, it's such a luxury to have Two River Theater as an artistic home where I feel safe enough to take the risks, to go out on a limb. I don't have to worry about, you know, box office receipts or smash reviews in the New York Times, because what our audiences and what our family has said is that we value you just for who you are and what you bring to us. And whatever you've prepared, we're ready to just try it. You may not like it as much as the other one, or we may like it more, but that's inconsequential. We have a history now with this theater, and with you that we trust you. And that level of trust is so rare in the American theater. And so to answer your question, Doug, is it me who can pitch or is it John? I don't know. I think it's more of the audience saying yes and allowing us to continue the exploration, on whether it be as through an actor or a director. I don't know. I really don't know. It's pretty seamless at this point. And it's almost something that we can take for granted that when it is time to do another August Wilson play, that, you know, myself or Ruben or one of these other actors and directors, well, only Ruben and I have directed here in August Wilson play so far, but we will be first to be considered because of the trust that you all have placed in us.
When I was doing some research and I realized that August had not seen this play when it, you know, he had already passed before it went to Broadway, immediately thought of Jonathan Larson not really getting to see the full run of Rent. These two iconic playwrights and two tremendous shows. Wonder what August Wilson would say now about Radio Golf that maybe he didn't think about. Have you thought about that?
I do. I think about it often. This play, Radio Golf, when you see it, it's a slight departure from some of his signature pieces in terms, I mean, it's, first of all, it's about 20 pages shorter than most of them. And it doesn't have as many yarns that he spins in some of the other plays. It is much more transactional, this play, but I think it absolutely speaks to the time he's writing about. I mean, just most, like if you saw King Henry II, the tenor of that, the metabolism of that play spoke to the 80s and what was going on, you know, in that community in the 80s. And that's a very different play than the Ma Rainey that we presented, which happened in the 20s, or Two Trains Running, which happened in the 70s. Each piece is of itself. Although it's linked and it's connected and there's a through line, the voices are very different. I think this one is distinctly different. And I think August, hopefully, my hope is, if he saw this production, he would be proud of himself that he was able to capture with such acuity the rhythms of 1997 in context of the rest of his plays. And you get to see a playwright who is almost multilingual. The language of 1997 is so different from the language of 1960s, 1970s. In terms of, when I say language, not the English language is any different, but what we care about, and that's what I'm talking about. The language of, in this play, I'll use this word again, is much more of a transactional language. It's all about business. What can I get? What can I do? And it's not always in relationship to seeing the whole other person. Sometimes it's about how does this further me and my efforts. You know, and so I think if August saw this play and how it sits with audiences now and the cautionary tale that it is about what happens, how are the edges frayed, how are communities broken down when we become so transactional, I think he would be extremely proud of what he has put out into this world to make us stop and realize it ain't all about what you can spend. It's not always about that, and we have characters even say that in the play. He says, I prefer to have something you can't spend, that money can't buy. And I think it's remarkable that he's captured that in his last play to leave us with. And more than that, I think what he does with this play, he asks more questions than he provides answers. And with that, he says, now I've done my work. Now you do your work. I've given you these 10 plays. As a roadmap, as a manuscript, to get back to being whole, to get back to being healthy, to get back to interpersonal relationships. So here is what I have to say about humanity. Here's what I have to say about the American dream. And you're gonna be surprised of how patriotic August Wilson comes off in this play. And that's what really surprised me when I started really digging in, is how much of an American August Wilson really was. And it was uncompromising. And people don't really want to assign that to him because he challenged America to be America's best self. His plays are a critique on how we fall short of those promises that America gives to every citizen. But it is more patriotic than any of his other plays, in my opinion. And so he charges us with that. He says, here are the questions. Are you living up to it? Are you really fully participating? And are you standing in the way, or are you helping somebody to reach those ideals and those values that America has said we are all entitled to? You know, so I think it's a perfect play for this time. That's something that we're all struggling with right now today. What is it to be an American? What are those values that are not for sale? No matter your political ideology, what are those American values that we hold to be central and we hold to be indispensable in keeping this union together and trying to create a more perfect union for everybody?
Wish you were on the debate stage tonight.
You know, just like that's what theater does. We don't give the answers. We put the questions, and we have the audience sit out there and ask themselves those questions that we put for them. We don't give you the answers, and that's what I love about theater, is that each individual, you can see the same scene, and three people go out having three different ideas about what they saw. And it isn't necessarily a right way, wrong way. It's whatever way works for you.
There's one problem that I have with you directing. And that's when I hear that passion, is like, I want to see you on stage too. I want to see you direct yourself, you know. And so that we miss that sometimes with you just being the director. As a four-time great-grandfather, Wayne, you got that right, right?
Yes, sir.
First of all, what do they call you?
Papa.
Papa?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they come up to you and say, August Wilson, who is that? What do you tell them?
First of all, my grandkids are kind of scared of me. I did a film once where my grandson, I actually get to slap him and stuff. When my grandkids saw that, they won't come near me. They leave Papa alone. But they really don't, you know, they just know that I have my own little sense and stuff of where I am, and they really don't step over into my arena. You know, they say, Papa does what he does, and we just leave him alone and let him do it. We don't ask him how he does it or why he does it, just let him do it, you know.
Who was this man that in 1981 joined Houston's Ensemble Theater? What was he like back at that time?
Well, the theater was smaller than a third of this room, and it's just been, I don't know, the thing that we will call, like, the little, in some of the reviews, we will call the little black theater on 2M Street, things like that. And we had the Alley Theater there in Houston, I don't know if they're, but they're our big professional, and so everything theater-wise was rated how the Alley did shows. And so around 81, 82 or so, you know, the Ensemble Theater, which was called the Black Ensemble at that time, said, no, we have people who are representative, who are artists, and we want to be recognized for that. And we've made great shows. I can remember when our sets were drawn on a piece of butcher paper, and that would be our walls or something. Sometimes the cardboard would be our walls and stuff. And we've come so far from that to now that we're one of the largest black theaters in the country. We're actually one of the very few that actually owns their own building, and we're very proud of that. And we, you know, just it's just an atmosphere. Like being here, the people here make me feel really like I'm wanted, and they know how to treat their actors, make them feel comfortable, and make them want to come here and work. And it took a while, but the Ensemble has that effect, and it's a little different. We're more like a family because we've gone through so much to survive at the Ensemble that it's a feeling that's not anywhere in any other theater but the Ensemble. Only that part, that's backstage more than anything else. Everything else is pretty much, you know, pretty much fine. But we've come a long way. We've come a long way. And I don't know, I'm just grateful to be at the point where somebody's recognized to say, okay, he's got a little talent. And I know generally when I get in a cast, usually I'm the oldest one in there. And my responsibility is to kind of look over the kid and say, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, things like that. So, I mean, I'm just blessed that, you know, I come from South Carolina. I come from a little town that only has one Xerox machine in the town. We have one red light. You know, we have no grocery store. They closed down the schools eventually, so the kids got to go 10 miles down. And I had no idea that I would be involved in doing acting or anything like that. Being from Carolina, you either go to one of the three M's I see. You either go to the military, the ministry, or the Marines. So I cuss too much to go into the ministry. I don't want to fight nobody, so I ain't going to the Marines. And they had the mills and stuff, and I didn't want to go to work in the mills. So I came to Houston, and some kind of way I found my way on somebody's stage, and I just think that's where, you know, the good Lord wanted me to be, and that's where I'm at.
We're blessed that you're here, Wayne.
Thank you.
And we also understand why Brandon has reached out to you. We're going to open it up for a few questions here. You get your opportunity. Just please raise your hand, and we'll get the microphone to you who has a question for Brandon or Wayne. Right here. Amanda has a question.
My question is for both of you. I'd want to know what was your first introduction to August Wilson's work?
All right. This is Brandon. So I started my relationship with August Wilson's work when I was 11. This is about 30 years ago, for those playing at home. And there was a play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And it was the theater that that Wayne mentioned in Houston, the flagship theater in Houston, the Alley Theater. And what happened was I went to a middle school that had like a drama program. And the Alley, when they needed child actors, they would come to the middle school and they, you know, say, hey, we're auditioning, come on over and you can audition for these plays. And at this time, they were auditioning for A Christmas Carol, which I desperately wanted to be in. But I don't sing well. I don't dance well. So how did I think I was going to be in A Christmas Carol? I do not know. But that's what I wanted to do. So I go and we audition for that. And then the callbacks come out for A Christmas Carol. And my name is not on the list. And I'm devastated. But the casting director comes out and says, hey, we're doing this other play. Do you have time to stick around and maybe read for the director of this other play? And I say, yeah, if I got to, I'll, yeah, sure. But the director of this other play, which I mentioned, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, was a fellow by the name of Claude Perdie. And Claude Perdie was actually August's best friend. And Claude tells it, I think August has affirmed this, but Claude is pretty responsible for getting August to start writing plays. August had been a poet, and they were chums and comrades in Pittsburgh in the 60s. And Claude had moved to Minneapolis, where there's a playwright center there. And so he got August to move to Minneapolis and really start flourishing, fleshing out ideas for plays. And Penumbra produced a couple of his early works. And then he submitted plays to the O'Neill Festival, where Lloyd Richards discovered the great August Wilson now. But Claude knew him all the way back from Pittsburgh days. And so when Lloyd would direct the original productions on, in the regions and then on Broadway, when it started going out for regional premieres after it was on Broadway, Claude would be one of the first calls to direct regional premieres of the work. And so this was the production that starred the late, great Roscoe Lee Brown and a bunch of other Houston, well-known Houston actors. And so at 11 years old, I got my shot to play Reuben, the little boy, the neighbor next door, and Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And there was an actor, I told this story before, but there was an actor in that play, Alex Allen Morris. And I think at this point, August had maybe written three plays, or four. Maybe there was Fences, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, I believe. I think that was all he had written. And he didn't even have an idea of writing the 10-play cycle at this point. But Alex saw something in me as an actor. He knew I wanted to do this professionally. He says, remember this man's name because he's going to feed your family. And 30 years later, here I am working at Two River, feeding my family by directing the works of August Wilson's. And it's so special because I am of the first generation of men in this country that can play the youngest guy August ever wrote and hopefully grow into playing the oldest guy August ever wrote. And I see that as a badge of honor.
We're so glad that you didn't make A Christmas Carol. There'd be a whole new Brandon J. Durden. Chase would be going, what? Christmas Carol? Dad? They really don't understand what they're talking about. Wayne, when did you give you the opportunity?
Mine was Fences. I actually was in a touring show called Camp Logan, which is about the Houston riots of 1917. Any of you, I'd love to tell you about that, too. But anyway, so I saw this theater in Greenville, South Carolina, was going to do Fences. And I said, well, I got to go get an audition. So I went and met the artistic director, and we talked about it. I told him, I'm on the road right now, but I will come off the road to do Troy in Fences. And he said, fine, okay, we'll do that. Came time for the auditions, and Greenville was where my hometown is. It's about 45 miles from there. So I had to get an uncle of mine to drive me up there and everything. And we had auditions. So the director said, well, is there any other character that you want to audition for, come on, do it now before we end the night. And I'm like, no, I'm going to play Troy. And we talked about this, so nothing else I want to audition for. 2 weeks go by. I don't hear from him. I pick up the phone. I said, did you cast the show? He says, yes, I did. I'd like for you to play Bono. What? Bono? No, no. I can walk in anybody's theater in this country and do Bono. I don't want to do that. We had cast this guy who was 6'4". I don't know if you know the story of Fences, but it's about a guy, frustrated garbage man who thought he could have played big league baseball. James Earl Jones played the role, so everybody that they cast figures has to be 6'4", 200 pounds and stuff. And this gentleman was maybe 25 years old, but he was 6'4", weighed 200 pounds. And he cast him as Troy. I went home, and I didn't think about it anymore. Then 2 more weeks go by, and I get a phone call. Says, Wayne, I'm having problems. Can you come? Would you please play Bono for me? I need you to play Bono. Shit, I guess this is going to be karma points I'm going to get. Okay, all right, I'll go do it, you know. So when I get there, he sits me down. He says, I want you to play Troy. He said, the guy was playing, he went off on me. He started telling the cast how good he was and everything, and he wasn't ready. So it was 3 days before they opened, and it just so happened. I had been at home reading my script because I didn't have nothing to do in Jonesville, South Carolina, but read a script. So I said, okay. So I was like maybe 75% off book for the first rehearsal, and then I stayed up all night, drank 2 bottles of tequila. And about 2 days later, I was ready. So the director says, Wayne, okay, just put him on your back. Wherever Wayne takes you, just go with him and let him. He says, Wayne, if I ever cast you, if I miscast you again, you have permission to tell me I'm wrong. You know. And I said, I promised him I would. I said, you probably won't get the chance to cast me, but I'm not going to work for you. So that was Fences was my first one.
Let's take one more question. Somebody has a question right there, sir. Please tell us who you are.
I'm Pete Cavalier. Just moved to Red Bank about a year ago. I live across the street from the theater here, so it's a short walk for me. And my wife and I have been subscribers for, I guess, a dozen years here at the theater.
Fabulous.
The question I have is directed to both gentlemen. Have either of you visited the Hill District in Pittsburgh and walked through the neighborhood to try to get a sense of the settings in Wilson's plays, to try to get a feel for, you know, what that neighborhood was all about?
I have. I'm long overdue for another visit. It's changed quite a bit since the last time I was there. I think the last time I was there was maybe, it was in the early 2000s, maybe 2001, 2002. And I did, and actually a mutual friend, he's talking about the Ensemble Theater back in Houston. The current artistic director there now is a woman, wonderful woman, one of my directors when I was a boy still living in Houston, Eileen Morris. And she had a teaching position at a college in Pittsburgh. And so one year I drove through Pittsburgh, and she gave me a walking tour around the Hill District in a neighborhood. And it is something about that walk and those, I mean, the hills alone. I mean, in Houston, as flat as they come. And getting acclimated to that landscape, the ups and the downs, you hear the poetry of life in those hills of the Hill District. And it's one thing to have been a student of August Wilson, but it's another thing to walk those steps and to see those streets, Bedford Avenue and Stuyvesant, and the things that are mentioned in this plays, and be able to, you know, just to actually see it, the physical representation of what he was. And one thing you see immediately is how much he loved the Hill. It's one thing to read those plays, but when you walk there and you see the accuracy and the detail that he described him in, here is a man who loved his community. And so when I approach his work after visiting the Hills, there's a newfound appreciation and say, I need to, the love that I have for his work, even though I thought it was already limitless, it added another layer of appreciation, having been on that physical ground and knowing the streets that he was writing about and having that sight and that smell and that feel of it. It's for me, it really was a pilgrimage.
Closest I've come was when we were touring that show about Camp Logan. I was in a van and we drove through Pittsburgh, and about all I saw was this big circle where people drive around at somewhere there. I don't even know where it was. But no, I've seen all the pictures. Eileen has brought me all the pictures and described all the places and stuff, but now I've actually never had the opportunity to walk Pittsburgh. I don't do that when I'm walking no more, so.
I do want to mention that Nathan James, who plays Sterling Johnson, is a proud native of Pittsburgh. Had a chance to meet him before we had this session tonight, and he is super excited. And we're going to shout out to his family also in Pittsburgh.
I think listening. It's his first August Wilson one, I believe, isn't it?
I know he's working on other, maybe professional.
I think he said, because he could never get cast. He said while he was in Pittsburgh, he'd never get cast in an August Wilson play. He had to come all the way up to New York and get cast in an August Wilson play.
So we want to give Nathan a little shout-out. Robbie Williams plays Roosevelt Hicks. Ambery Bond plays Mame Wilkes. And Carl Hendrick Lewis plays Harmon Wilkes. That makes up the cast along with Wayne DeHart. I am sure after you've heard these two gentlemen talk, you are ready to know that February 29th through March 22nd, right here at Two River Theater, August Wilson's Radio Golf. We can't wait for this show to begin. As people leave the theater, maybe not tonight, but after they see the show, Brandon, I want you to tell us what you want them to be thinking about.
I want you to be thinking about how many people you can bring to see the show again. You know, it's too good to keep it to yourself. Share it, people. Share it. You know, I really do want you to think wherever this play takes you, whatever ride that these 2 hours have taken you on, it's okay. Think about that. I don't want to dictate your experience. I just want to try and be a faithful guide for you as you have your own personal journey with a room full of other people having their personal journey and knowing that ultimately it's about the same destination, and that's love. That is love of self, and that is love for another.
We're here at the Center for New Work Education and Design. It's a beautiful new space here at Two River Theater, and you can thank yourselves, because if you didn't come to these plays, this would never have happened. So this is also Hackensack Meridian Health, Riverview Medical Center, Studio B, to be exact. So Joan and Robert Rechnick's Theater, August Wilson's Radio Golf, directed by Obie Award winner Brandon J. Jordan, and starring Wayne DeHart as Elder Joseph Barlow. Gentlemen, what a pleasure to have you here tonight.
Thank you, Doug. Always, my man. Always.
We have a packed room here. We want to thank you for coming in, as Brandon said, taking some time out before the play has even started to learn more about Radio Golf. We look forward to seeing you here at the theater. A reminder, this will air on WBGO. It'll be this Saturday at 6:30 in the morning, but we'll also be online at WBGO.org. You'll be able to hear the entire show, so if your friends missed it, please tell them about it. Radio Golf, the last play from the amazing August Wilson. We'll see you here starting February 29th. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to give credit before we leave to the whole crew here at Two River Theater, especially Dan Montana for helping us with the sound, Cassie Galassetti for setting this all things up here. So thanks to the whole crew, and have a wonderful evening.